All right, good morning. So no power at home, so no printout outline from home. Couldn't figure out the printer here either. I think it's a new printer, but it was something was off about it. It's no big deal. So I brought an iPad for my outline. So we'll see how this goes. But the lesson today is meant to be a sequel to the lesson last week. So last week we talked about the reliability of the Bible, kind of what the Bible is, and just kind of thinking about evidences that should help us see the Bible as the most trustworthy historical set of documents that literally exists in the world. I was listening to a lecture from a scholar on historical subjects, and he's looked into the biblical texts in terms of how old they are, how reliable they are. And he just mentioned in his lecture that the letters of the New Testament are ancient historical documents. You know, even if someone doesn't believe in the miracles of the Gospels or the claim that Jesus is the Son of God, he mentioned in his lecture none of that. How a person believes what they believe about the writings does not change the fact that these are ancient historical documents that have been preserved to an incredible degree over time. So anyway, yeah, last week we looked at the reliability of the Bible in terms of the books, the preservation of the writings. This morning we're going to be talking about the reliability of Jesus as a historical figure. And I want to ask you the question, how important is it that we have confidence in the person of Jesus? I would say that's the most important thing about our lives in general. If it's true that Jesus really lived the life that the Gospels claim he lived, if it's really true that he died on the cross and rose from the dead, what we think about Jesus and the conclusions we come to about Jesus is literally the most important thing about our lives. We cannot afford to take it lightly, whether or not Jesus was the person he's presented to be. And I want you to think, you know, sometimes our faith can be based in our environment. Sometimes our faith can be because of social pressure. It could be because it's convenient again, it's familiar. Maybe it's because it's just our church culture to believe. But that's none of those things are really enough. You know, again, it's good that there's a church culture that, you know, encourages faith. It's good that maybe we have family environments that encourage faith. That's good. It's good that the gospel is conveniently in our access. That's a good thing. But ultimately, our faith can't be based in any of those things. We need to have a faith where we ask hard questions about Jesus and come to reasoned and critical thinking conclusions about who Jesus is. And God invites this kind of investigation in Scripture. So really, an introductory point about this is it's not bad to be skeptical. You know, the idea that God, who created everything, came into a form of a man who was crucified and 3 days later rose from the dead, and that means you can have eternal life, that's a pretty extraordinary claim, right? That is a very extraordinary claim. The disciples, as it's written in the Gospels, the disciples had a hard time believing Jesus had risen. And there's even records at the end of the Gospels that say Jesus was standing right in front of them and they were struggling to believe, right? It's an extraordinary claim. It's not wrong to be skeptical. In fact, I appreciate it if I'm studying with someone and they ask a lot of hard questions. And a lesson like this has really two things. Number one, it's to show you that it's okay to ask hard questions because there are answers for those questions, and there is maybe more evidence for Jesus as a historical figure than you may have realized before. And number two, for us who I believe have faith in Jesus, I would hope that a lesson like this would just put us in awe at the amount of solid evidence there is in the reality that Jesus was a historical figure. You know, so for me, what I like to tell people in evangelism is my faith is based on Jesus as a true historical figure. You know, the thing about historical events, either they happened or they didn't. You know, you can debate scientific things and, you know, a lot of things can be said about that. You can debate things philosophically, logically, morally, and there's usefulness to those debates, right? But the thing about history is things either happened or they did not happen. Either Jesus came into our world or he didn't. And if he didn't, fine. But if he did, and if the Gospels present a reliable eyewitness account of what Jesus taught, how he lived his life, how he died, and that he did rise from the dead, then the reality is we have to deal with that, right? And we need to help people around us to deal with that reality as well. So this is an important question, and we're not going to look back at the scripture reading passages. We'll kind of touch on those later. This is going to be a very different kind of lesson. It's going to be filled with a lot of quotes from a lot of people that would be considered scholars in the world in different fields of study. And I'm inviting you in this lesson to take a journey with me. I'm really glad the power's on at the building because this lesson really depends on a PowerPoint. Like, you could maybe follow along pretty okay by just me spewing the information, but I think a PowerPoint is really going to help. So again, I'm super thankful that the power is on for this one. So let's start. First of all, prophecy. The reality is the Dead Sea Scrolls date before the time of Jesus by about 300 years, meaning the Old Testament was not modified by Christians to fit an agenda. The Old Testament scriptures, the prophecies they contain, are exactly what they had before Jesus was ever claimed to have lived. And Ralph Mooncaster is a scholar, an academic person, who actually somehow did this math. So Ralph Mooncaster is quoted as saying, the estimated odds of just 48 prophecies, so I think it's supposed to be 48, the likelihood of Jesus fulfilling just 48 prophecies would be equivalent to a person winning 22 lotteries in a row back to back. Now, he has an actual number, but it's like, it's a number so big, it's like, I don't even understand the number, but his illustration that it's like 22 lottery wins back to back to back really starts to kind of put it in perspective. Like, if you bought a lottery ticket, you know, I'm not advocating you do that. I don't think that's morally very good to do something like that and participate in, but anyway, you know, you would know that it's very, 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 very minuscule chances that you would ever win something that like that, much less 22 times in a row. And when you start adding it together, 48 prophecies isn't even touching the gambit of what Jesus did. Three things here. It's not just direct prophecies. Jesus fulfilled a plethora of Old Testament figures. So three anchoring prophecies, Deuteronomy 18:18. The Messiah would be a prophet like Moses, and that would mean lawgiver, an Exodus leader, a miracle worker, an intercessor. And this open promise here, the Jews understood that Deuteronomy 18 is a Messiah promise. You know, they went to John the Baptist, are you the prophet? They're referencing Deuteronomy 18. So the Jews in Jesus' day, they knew that this was a Messiah promise. That's a big obligation to come as a new Moses. A king like David, 1 Chronicles 17, and this is referenced in the prophets again and again. The Messiah would be a king like David. He would fulfill who David was, meaning he would fulfill the experiences of David, the attitude of David, the conflicts of David, the rule of David, the judgments of David, the suffering of David. And this would be an everlasting throne, 1 Chronicles 17. Psalm 110, a very obscure, very important prophecy. That the Messiah would be even a priest, according to the order of Melchizedek. Somehow, the Messiah figure would be both prophet, king, and also priest, all at the same time somehow. Just those three prophecies, the task of fulfilling those three prophecies and all the threads involved is incredible. But not only that, and again, we're just skimming here. The Old Testament prophesied how Jesus would be born. That's Isaiah chapter 7, verse 15, where he would be born in Bethlehem, Micah 5, verse 2, where he would start his ministry, Isaiah 9, verse 1, what he would teach, Isaiah 2 and others, controversies he would face, we see this throughout the Psalms and the prophets, the kind of people he would focus on in his ministry, we see this especially in Psalm 72, miracles he would even perform in Isaiah 35. It talks about the lame walking, the blind seeing, the deaf hearing. The nature of his character is in the Old Testament prophets. Isaiah 42 is an example of that. How he would die, Isaiah 53 and Psalm 52. Why he would die in Isaiah 53. And that he would rise from the dead, Psalm 16, that his body would not see physical corruption. How his life would change the world, Isaiah 60 and 61, among many, many others. Not only that, Jesus fulfilled the teaching of the law. He fulfilled the sacrifices, the priests, the temple structure, the Jewish holidays, Passover. Jesus is the Passover lamb. Jesus fulfilled narrative historical events throughout the history of Israel. Jesus fulfilled both God's covenant with man on his side and God's covenant with man on man's side. Jesus fulfilled concepts of salvation, justice, mercy, righteousness, faith. And so it's not just that Jesus fulfilled a few very direct, very literal pointed prophecies. It's that Jesus fulfilled a plethora of prophecies, things that aren't even referenced in the Gospels or the letters written to churches, things that exceed 48 prophecies that would already be equivalent to winning 22 lotteries. And these prophecies are unmodified writings from over two dozen authors over the span of 1,000 years of cumulative writing, not the same authors, not the same cultures, and Jesus fulfilled more than 48 prophecies. Then you have historical testimony. You may not be aware of this, but Jesus is actually referenced through history by a lot of different people, and I'm going to keep it really early. Josephus is a Jewish historian. He's not a believer. You know, Josephus actually wrote in length about John the Baptist, like in length. He wrote a lot about John. I have one quote. Now, some of the Jews thought that the destruction of Herod's army came from God as a just punishment of what Herod had done against John, who is called the Baptist. For Herod had killed this good man who had commanded the Jews to exercise virtue, righteousness towards one another, and piety towards God. And again, he writes on and on about John. It's quite impressive, actually. And he makes a reference to Jesus. And again, Josephus is not a Christian. He's not even a good Jew. Josephus was more a Roman than he was a Jew. However, he was a Jew. Josephus writes, "So he assembled the Sanhedrin of judges." He's talking about James's death, James the Apostle. Not James the Apostle, I'm sorry, James the brother of Jesus. "So he assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others." Just a passive reference, you know, that there's this person, James, who was put to death, brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ. He's not saying he believes that Jesus was the Christ, that that's just what Jesus was called. Oh, and by the way, Jesus' brother James was put to death. You've got Marabar Serapion, and I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. He lived in the first century, and this is a writing that is unanimously, universally considered trustworthy. So he doesn't say Jesus, but it's universally accepted he's referring to Jesus. So Marabar Serapion, he's referring to the fact that Jerusalem was destroyed. He's reflecting on it after Jerusalem is already destroyed. What advantage did the Jews gain from executing their wise king? It was just that after their kingdom was abolished, God justly avenged these three wise men. He references the Athenians and Samians. So he's talking about other cultures that collapsed because of some horrible thing that they did. And he's saying the Jews did this to their wise king. And then he references, well, Socrates isn't dead because of Plato. Neither is Pythagoras because of the statue of Juno. What he's saying is these people live on through the writings about them. And just so the wise king, because of all of the new laws he laid down. First century, you have someone, and again, Marabar is not a believer. He's just writing down some passive things about history, that the Jews, their city was destroyed, seemingly because of this great injustice against their wise king, but he lives on through the writings about him. Suetonius, again, lived during the first century and might have written this in the first century. He's talking about the Jews being expelled from Rome. Since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, that is Christ, he expelled them from Rome. Punishment by Nero was inflicted on Christians, a class of men given to a new and mischievous superstition. Romans hated Christianity. Pliny the Younger, another person who hated Christianity. So this is actually a government official in a letter to another government official over him. He doesn't know what he should do about Christians. He knows it's criminal, but he's not sure how to punish them. And so he's investigating. And so he's asking, what should I do to people who I find out are Christians? So he says, "Having never been present at any trials concerning those who profess Christianity, I am unacquainted not only with the nature of their crimes or the measure of their punishment, but how far it is proper to enter into an examination concerning them. They affirm the whole of their guilt or their error was that they met on a stated day before it was light and addressed the form of a prayer to Christ as to a divinity." And again, this is about 110 AD, a government official, not a Christian. and just investigating the nature of Christianity. Tacitus, consequently, to get rid of the part, this is not a believer again. Tacitus is someone who had no stake in the game here. Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero is a Roman emperor who started a fire and blamed it on Christians and then tortured them. Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. And a most mischievous superstition, just thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, and the evil he's referring to is Christianity. But even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. And that's just naming a few, right? Jesus is referenced extremely early from people who are not Christians, and that is not even taking into account biblical writings and quotations from early Christians who also wrote around these time frames as well. Here's something that you may not have thought about, and this isn't talked about enough, Jesus' life and culture. Did you know that Jesus lived in an incredibly complex culture and history? Tom Holland, who is a historian who takes special interest in Greek and Roman culture, Tom Holland writes that in Jesus' time specifically, tension, and Tom Holland is not a Christian, by the way. He would consider himself an agnostic. So he acknowledges, as a historian, he does believe Jesus really lived in history. He doesn't necessarily trust the biblical writings, but he's a historian, right? He believes that Jesus really lived in history. So here's what he says. In Jesus' time, the tension between Judea and the Roman government was reaching a peak, and also the tension between the common people of Galilee and the religious elitists in Jerusalem. Then there are multiple cultures, even within the Jewish culture, that are themselves complex. And then you have tension with the Samaritans. You have attitudes toward the Gentiles. So what he's trying to get to is, Jesus's region and time frame have an incredible degree of layers of complexity. And Tom Holland's point in pointing these things out is no matter what you find through history, you find that the Gospels, in his words, elucidate history. Meaning the Gospels actually not only align with history and what is found in history, but actually they make it more clear. And this is very risky. Did you know that there is no other religious writing that makes an attempt to be grounded in historical reality? The only one is in the Books of Mormon. Joseph Smith has a book where a prophet, when Jerusalem was being sieged by Babylon, he writes that a prophet killed a few people and then escaped from Jerusalem and then came to America. And when he came to America, he established a new priesthood and built an equivalent temple to Solomon's. And there continued Judaism in America. But first of all, the Book of Mormon and the writings are pretty crazy. But the regions show a complete lack of understanding of the regions when investigated. There is no historical evidence for the claims at all. And so even when passively investigated, when considered with any scrutiny, it all turns into a bunch of silliness. Besides that, the Quran is a bunch of sayings written about by one single man, just a bunch of sayings. Where did I have that in my notes? It's a very complicated name. I'll find it at some point here as we go through this. There it is, the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita in Hinduism is one of the most important writings for the Hindu religion, and it's just presented as myth. You know, it's a guy who's going on a spiritual journey in the face of a war where he's not sure what to do in the war because he has friends who are on the opposing side. And so a spirit takes him on a long religious journey. And even the battle itself, Hindus say, well, it's really just an allegory for the battle within that we all face as well. The Gospels, I think we're so familiar with it, we take for granted the fact that it's a religious writing grounded in historic reality. And that is unlike any kind of religious writing, much less history in ancient times. Tom Holland would mention, or not Tom Holland, Peter Williams, another academic, states that the Gospels are more accurate to the Palestinian locations and geography than the writings of Josephus. A detailed, very long-winded historian who lived in Judea and wrote a lot about Judea, the Gospels are more accurate to Palestine and its locations and geography than the writings of Josephus. And all of this is very risky. And the risks continue to escalate in the Gospels. The more authors you allow to write about this, the riskier it becomes. The Books of Mormon were written by one guy. That plays it pretty safe. The Quran, written by Muhammad, playing it pretty safe. All of these other religious writings, they're safely held by one singular writer. And then when you read those writings, it's also pompous. You know, they mock the people. The writings, you know, have a lot of sayings mocking people who don't accept the writings. They don't accept it at face value. Well, you know, they're going to go to hell. They're going to be condemned for not believing the writings. You know, it's not inviting any kind of scrutinous investigation. The Gospels, multiple people wrote Gospel accounts. And then if you include Paul and Peter in their writings, in the epistles as testimonies of Jesus, you have a multitude of witnesses, including Old Testament passages that look forward to the Messiah. The more people you include in writing about it, the riskier it gets. Because if someone is in error, if someone is inconsistent, you've got a big problem. The more names you include in the narrative. You know, so I mentioned the Gospel of Thomas last week. It really doesn't name very many people. Again, the Gospel of Thomas is just sayings, and there's just a couple people mentioned throughout. Gospel of Thomas, by the way, only mentions Jerusalem geographically. The Gospels mention 27 locations, which again is very risky if those places didn't exist. Anyway, there's a really interesting thing here. Richard Bauckham, this scholar, studied patterns of names in history. The Gospels have a lot of people's names, and this is very risky. And what Richard Bauckham found is the patterns of names in the New Testament, and even the frequency of names, like there's a lot of Marys. You know, there's a lot of different, why am I forgetting the name all of a sudden? There's a lot of Marys and there's a lot of others. Anyway, Richard Bauckham studying the pattern of names in the Gospels compared to what we know from history, and he found that even the patterns of names from history in the time frame of Jesus literally flawlessly matches the frequency of names in the Gospel that are popular, the frequency of names historically outside of the Bible. It perfectly aligns together. No other religious writing takes the risks of having all sorts of people being named. So the more people you name in the writing, the riskier it becomes. You know, the more you include people like government officials, the riskier it becomes. The more circumstances you write about, the riskier it becomes. The more interactions you include within the narrative, the riskier it becomes. Again, the Quran is just constant sayings, one after another. It's not interactive. There's no controversy involved. The Book of Mormon with Joseph Smith, again, it's just sayings being given to him, one after another, and spoken in much pomp, with the fact that if you don't just take it at face value, well, you're going to hell if you don't believe the prophet. Now, this is historically grounded. It is unlike any other religious text. It is unlike even ancient history. Everything pales in comparison to the way the Bible is written. Again, there's no religious writing in history. There isn't, that compares even closely to the Gospel. There's someone named William Ramsey. He's someone that is dead now, but he's a legendary historian. William Ramsey was an atheist who read the book of Acts, and he was an atheist, and what he wanted to do was disprove the history that you find in the book of Acts, that it's unreliable. After he took it upon himself to investigate it, William Ramsey later said this: "I take the view that Luke's history is unsurpassed in its trustworthiness. You may press the words of Luke in a degree beyond any other historian, and they will stand the keenest scrutiny and the harshest treatment." That's someone who is an atheist, and by investigation on the locations, the places, the geography that the Bible claims to have taken place in, it all lines up. The idea is, if you scrutinize the culture of the Gospel, and you don't take for granted, well, of course it is what it is, of course it's written the way it is, there's no other religious text that includes so many names of people, names of politicians in the time frame that accurately represents an incredibly complex culture and addresses those controversies in a way that elucidates the history rather than undermining it or contradicting it. And then we get to Jesus' teaching itself. Jesus' teachings are incredibly profound, shockingly concise, and Jesus invites scrutiny. You know what else elevates the risk of the Gospels? When you demand reference. You know, again, the Quran, it originates from Muhammad. You just have to take it at face value. The books of Joseph Smith, you just have to take it at face value. The Bhagava, whatever, in Hinduism, you just have to take it at face value. Jesus did not operate on that basis. When you have a body of text you are claiming to fulfill, you immediately dramatically escalate the risk of whatever it is you're doing in teaching. In Matthew 5, 17 through 18, Jesus said he did not come to abolish the law or the prophets. He came to fulfill it all. He said, not even the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until it is accomplished. And I think within that, he's including the whole body of Old Testament writing. That's 39 books of established writings that Jesus is saying, what I'm doing, what I'm teaching, reference it back because it's all connected. That elevates the risk of the Gospels exponentially. If there are contradictions, it all falls apart. If there's inconsistency, it all falls apart. Luke 24, he claims that his life, his death, his resurrection, it was written about in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms. In John chapter 5 and John 10, Jesus does not mock people in pomp and say, take it at face value, guys, I'm the Messiah, and you're going to hell if you don't believe me. John 5, he says, if I testify about myself, don't believe it. He says, the scriptures, you guys are Jews! Reference the scriptures. Test what I'm saying. And he tells them, if you don't believe Moses, you're not going to believe me because he wrote about me. John 10, he says, if I don't do the works of my Father, don't believe me. He's saying, don't take it at face value. You want to scrutinize me? Go ahead. You want to question me? Do it. If I'm not doing the works of my Father, don't bother believing me. But if I do them, though you do not believe me, believe the works, so that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father. You know what's risky about Jesus? He doesn't just claim to teach fulfillments of the law or fulfill the role of man and the obligation of man. Jesus claims to fulfill God's role in the form of man. That means when you're reading about the task of man in the covenant in the Old Testament, you're reading about what Jesus would do. And behind the scenes, when you are reading about God's role, the role of God in the Old Testament, you are reading about the work that Jesus would do. Jesus claimed that his work, his role, would not just be to teach things that fulfill the Old Testament, not just to fulfill man's role as you read it in the 39 volumes of Old Testament writing, but that he would also fill God's role in the Old Testament writings. Okay, the problem of the geography, the names, the interactions, the fact that so much teaching is based in interaction and controversy just continues elevating the risks of the narrative, the history of the gospel. And then culturally, did you know Jesus' longest sermon takes less than 15 minutes to preach, which would have been 13 minutes ago for this sermon? 13 minutes ago, Jesus would have been done with the Sermon on the Mount. And that's being generous. It probably would have taken 13 minutes. You know what the Jews were familiar with in the culture of Jesus' day was the Talmud, which is over 6,000 pages. If you put English and Hebrew together for a translation, it's double this, right? This is a picture of 20 volumes of the Talmud, which is the Jewish traditions considered to be authoritative in Jesus' day. It's also commentary on the Old Testament considered authoritative by rabbis. This is what they're familiar with. Jesus' longest sermon was less than 15 minutes. And did you know in that sermon, less than 15 minutes, he covered 20 topics. And I'm being modest about that. I went through, I tried to modestly separate the topics. Modestly, 20 topics, less than 15 minutes. Every topic is handled with definitive precision and illustration. And there's other historians who've looked into the history of different writings. Peter Williams here says, the parables of Jesus are unparalleled in history in their nature, their application, and their cleverness. It's not before seen in older Jewish writings, nor seen in Christian writings from that time on. What he's saying is, The parables of Jesus came from nowhere. There's nothing like it in ancient writings. Christians didn't have a habit of making parables after the time of Jesus. And what you see in the Jewish writings in things like the Dead Sea Scrolls, you don't see people just coming up with parables. And he continues to make it more complicated. He said, this is Peter Williams, Jesus's parables draw from universal reality. They draw from the Jewish culture. They draw from the Roman culture. They draw from Jewish history. They draw from tensions in the culture. They draw from Jesus' life and the anticipation of what his life, death, and resurrection would involve. And all of this teaching is interlaced by narrative. I cannot stress enough to have religious teaching interlaced with narrative and interaction is unparalleled in any religious writing at any point in history. From that time and even since, there is no religious writing anywhere near the kind of historic grounding that the Gospels have. The idea is Jesus's teaching is unparalleled. Whatever you want to believe about the Gospel, there is nothing like Jesus's teaching that exists. A couple of quotes here. Tom Holland is a historian, like I said, on Greek and Roman culture, and while investigating Greek and Roman culture, he was disturbed. He got into being a historian because he admired the Greeks. He admired the Romans. It's beautiful. It's powerful. Their images are amazing. But he mentions as he got into their minds, he was deeply disturbed at their morals. They were ruthless. They were violent. They had little value to human life. And so Tom Holland was curious about this, and he wrote a book called Dominion, where he tried to trace the source of our modern morals. You know, if I can't relate to the Mormons or the Greeks or these other ancient cultures, why do I feel disturbed by this? Where does my moral compass come from? He's not a believer, by the way. He wrote a book called Dominion, where he traced that in every place the gospel spread in history, the moral compass of those cultures changed forever. He's famous for saying that in America especially, we are living in a Christian fishbowl. His point is that people who are atheists are breathing in the waters of Christian ethics without realizing it or acknowledging it. His point is, before Jesus, before Christianity, the world was a much more immoral place. There wasn't anything like social justice that you can find in the world. Modern ethics owe themselves entirely, according to Tom Holland, to the teaching of Jesus. Philip Schaff, Jesus of Nazareth, without money, without arms, conquered more millions than Alexander, Caesar, Muhammad, and Napoleon. Without science and learning, he shed more light on things human and divine than all philosophers and scholars combined. Without the eloquence of schools, he spoke such words of life as were never spoken before or since, and produced effects which lie beyond the reach of the orator or poet. Without writing a single line, he set more pens in motion and furnished themes, more sermons, orations, discussions, learned volumes, works of art, songs of praise, than the whole army of great men of ancient and modern times. Christ stands solitary and alone among the heroes of history and presents to us an insolvable problem. Unless we admit him to be more than man, even the eternal Son of God. Jesus' death and resurrection. Yeah. Told you we were going on a journey. We're moving through this very quick. The point of this lesson is to overwhelm. The crucifixion was not a punishment in the Old Testament. We take for granted, of course, the Gospels write about crucifixion. We're familiar with the symbol of the cross. The crucifixion was never something authorized for the Jewish nation to participate in. You have stoning, you have burning to death, you have things like that. You do not have crucifixion in the Old Testament. It was one of the most severe methods of Roman execution. Doesn't seem that any Jews were anticipating a crucified Messiah. But you know, the cross, it perfectly and yet surprisingly symbolized the joining together of Jew and Gentile. Everybody participated in the crucifixion of Jesus. The Jews participated, the Romans participated. And it begins what Jesus began. Jesus in the Gospels claims to be fulfilling the Old Testament system, but going so far beyond it, transcending it so far that it becomes something new. The cross begins joining together both Jews and Gentiles. We are all under the problem of sin. The problem of sin is not a Jewish problem. Being an enemy of God is not a Jewish problem. It is an everyone problem. And then the resurrection. The resurrection is more than just that Jesus rose from the dead. It's that God is proving he loves each person, no matter how lost they are, and can restore each person to his glory, no matter how dead they are in their sins. And the claim of the resurrection, it began in Jerusalem. It thrived in the city where it would receive the heaviest scrutiny. Again, we take for granted that the Gospels talk about crucifixion and resurrection. We're familiar with it. But you know, there's someone Tom Holland references in one of his lectures, this guy, Marissus. He says in history, we have one reference to Marissus. It's a guy who had a following of about 8,000 people. Marissus claimed to be divine, and his followers believed it. So you know what the Romans did? They fed him to animals publicly. And you know people stopped believing Marissus was divine after that, and his following came to nothing? Because the goal of the Romans were, if you're going to claim divinity, we're going to make sure we stomp that out because of the rebellion that would come from that. And you have multiple people like that in history where they claim to be divine. People think, oh, this person cannot die. They die and it comes to nothing. You know, if Jesus did not rise from the dead, his name may have become like Marissus. Maybe we have like some reference to Jesus in history, but kind of mysterious who this man was and what he taught. How do you explain the fact that Jesus died this violent death, not grounded in an execution permitted by the law of the Old Testament? That Jesus came into a very complex culture, that the Jews surrendered him to the Romans and participated in his death, demanding crucifixion, and the Romans yielded gladly, crucifying Jesus. And that the resurrection was claimed, again, in the city of Jerusalem, where the crucifixion would have happened, where it would receive the heaviest degree of scrutiny, and where believing in Jesus and preaching his resurrection would have been considered blasphemy, which would have involved death by Jewish persecution eventually. You know, the resurrection became an unstoppable force in the very city where it should have been put to a stop. And then finally, we have eyewitnesses, at least claimed eyewitnesses of Jesus. Look at Luke chapter 1, and we'll look at these passages. Luke chapter 1. Again, even if someone is skeptical, and they don't want to believe necessarily the claims of the Bible, you cannot deny the fact that these are ancient documents that are insanely preserved. These are spectacularly preserved through history. That universally it is accepted that these were written during the first century. Well, let's look at least what is claimed about these writings and the authors. Luke chapter 1. And as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word handed them down to us. Luke is claiming that he is writing because of eyewitness testimony of the things he's written about. If you go to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And again, what do you do about this? That they're making an extraordinary claim in cultures where this would have been something heavily persecuted, heavily scrutinized. And yet the concept of the resurrection, the preaching of the resurrection, is this unstoppable force that people are following en masse, not just among Jews, but even among the Gentiles. 1 Corinthians 15. Now I make known to you, brothers, the gospel which I proclaimed as good news to you, which also you received, in which you also stand, by which you are saved, if you hold fast the word which I proclaimed to you as good news, unless you believed for nothing. For I delivered to you as of first importance, which I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, and that he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. After that he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared to me also. And we read in the scripture reading 2 Peter 1, where Peter claims to be an eyewitness. 1 John 1, John claims to be an eyewitness. Now, what do you do about this? You have these men writing, they claim to be witnesses. And are their writings characteristic of liars? You know, this is not just one writer in pomp mocking you for not taking their word for it. It's incredibly risky to have multiple people claiming in their time frame that there are many witnesses of the same thing, many people writing about the same event, and inviting scrutiny, inviting investigation. 1 Corinthians, universally, so atheistic scholars who not only don't believe in God, they don't want you to believe in God. They cannot deny the fact that Paul was a true historical person, and that Paul really wrote these letters, and that Paul really was the person that he claims he was as a Pharisee who persecuted the church. That means it's universally accepted that 1 Thessalonians, 1 Corinthians, Galatians, and Romans in the 50 AD period, that these letters were written 20 years after Jesus supposedly died. 20 years! And you know what that means? Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians, this message had already spread, and that people already believed this message. So that means that before Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, which was written to people far away from Jerusalem, that this message within 20 years had already spread far beyond Judea and was not only convincing to one of the most aggressive opponents to Christianity, to convert him from being a Pharisee and a Jew among Jews, which even atheists acknowledge Paul really was the person in history he describes himself as. Now, what you do about what he wrote is another thing, right? It's universally accepted that Paul wrote these letters. So that presents us with a problem. When you put all of this together, the nature of the Gospels, the accuracy to history, the uniqueness of the writing, the narrative that involves teaching and interaction, the naming of so many different individuals, even political figures, the accuracy of it all, the nature of the teaching, the impact of the teaching, the uniqueness of the parables, the eyewitness testimony, the reliability of what's been preserved through history. What do you do about this? Something extraordinary happened in history. And Tom Holland, who is not a believer, Tom Holland would present himself as an agnostic. Tom Holland, as a historian, said any historian worth his salt will acknowledge that Jesus is a historical figure. If we could acknowledge Jesus really came into history, it demands the continued line of evidence that the Gospels are extraordinarily unique and accurate writings presenting the life of the person Jesus. That he lived, and he died, and he rose from the dead. I want to give you one implication of this that I think is critical. If Jesus really rose from the dead, then that means no matter what I may struggle with, no matter concepts that seem too big, if Jesus rose from the dead, then everything he said is true. That means I can struggle with big concepts, concepts of salvation, eternal life, and sin. But if Jesus is the one that said it, if he rose from the dead, then his word is truth. And I can plant my flag on that. Because we are going to struggle with the enormous concepts that Jesus came to teach. But if it's him that said it, it is true. Hang your hat on that. Plant your flag on that. If Jesus rose from the dead, if this happened in history, then that serves as the basis of authority for everything that he said. Everything he said is true. And that's where I'll end the lesson. I know that was a lot. I'm fully aware that was shooting with the fire hose. If you'd like the outline or the slides, I'd be happy to share them. But guys, this is just even skimming the surface of people who have invested scholarly study in a lot of different aspects of this, coming at it from an incredible degree of different angles, arriving at the same conclusion. We can trust Jesus is a historical figure. Jesus came into history, and Jesus changed history forever. And we are indebted to that reality now and for the rest of existence. Everyone is indebted to that reality. I'd like to pray for these things. And after that, we'll have a closing prayer, or a closing song, if you'll pray with me.